Hey, this is Dave Infante. Welcome to Fine Pairs Tap Lines, a weekly interview series with brewing icons, industry insiders, and outspoken experts about the United States' most beloved and best-selling beers. It's modern American history, one beer at a time. Nothing exists in a vacuum, Tap Lines listener, and beer certainly doesn't. The history of the brewing industry is littered with instances of direct and significant influence and interference from beyond the category. Don't believe me? Well, I highly recommend you go back and check out our episode with Edmundo Macias, the former brain lead on Anheuser-Busch's tequila-inspired Y2K-era Corona killer that never took off. Rest in peace, Tequiza. We hardly knew you. Today's episode is about a beer-adjacent product that did take off, moving cases like crazy in the 80s and putting beverage alcohol executives in every category on notice. California Cooler is credited with straight up creating the wine cooler segment, and its co-creator, Stuart Bewley, will join us here on Tap Lines in just a moment. Stay with us to hear how he and his co-founder dreamt up the idea for the single-serve fermented fruit-based ready-to-drink in the mid-70s and how its gangbusters success a decade later inspired copycats from industry heavyweights in the wine industry, where Gallo's Bartles and James was a near one-for-one clone, and in the beer industry, too. Go look up Miller's Matilda Bay, for example. Oh, and speaking of the beer industry, Bewley said the long-running boycott of a certain big-on-the-West-Coast brewer was instrumental in getting California Cooler onto the trucks of distributors who otherwise might have not had anything to do with it. Nothing exists in a vacuum, after all. It's Stuart Bewley, it's California Cooler, it's how wine coolers first went after beer drinkers, and it's all right here, right now, on Vine Pairs Tap Lines. Tap Lines, of course, listener, is a beer podcast, but beer does not exist in a vacuum. Beer exists in a broad landscape of all sorts of beverage alcohol and non-alcoholic beverages, too. And so you'd be a little foolish not to pay attention if you're interested in the beer industry or if you have a stake in it, in what's going on outside of it, you know, in these adjacent markets. We're going to be talking about an adjacent market today with someone who more or less created a co-created a red hot for a moment segment of that adjacent market. I'm talking, of course, about Stuart Bewley, who joins us today here in the Tap Lines virtual recording. Recording studio. Stuart, welcome, welcome to Tap Lines, my man.
Thank you, Dave.
Where are you joining us from, Stuart?
I'm in Belvedere, California.
Nice. We're coming, listeners, as always, I'm recording here in Richmond, Virginia. Stuart, we have here in the virtual Tap Lines studio a Tap Lines time machine, because this is a history podcast. We're going all over the post-prohibition American drinking landscape with our many guests, sometimes very recently, sometimes very, very far back, right to repeal. We always ask our guests, or these days we like to ask our guests, where do you think the story of the wine cooler that started it all, where does the story of California Cooler begin in your mind? What year should we go to?
1980.
Yeah. It's Reagan is entering the White House this year. Mm-hmm. It is the beginning of the generation, the decade of greed, as they would call it, in hindsight. Okay, where are you, Stuart, in 1980?
Well, I was working for a lumber company up in Portland, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And if you, probably too young for this, but in 1980, we had the oil embargo from OPEC, and
sure,
interest rates were 20%. The economy was absolutely in the tank. There were lines to get into a gas station that were 5 and 6 blocks long.
They had to do odds and evens on the license plate, right? You could only get gas on the day that your license plate number ended in.
Right. Businesses were going bankrupt right, left, and center.
Wow.
I was working for a lumber company, and housing starts were just absolutely stopped. The company was in desperate situation, and so everybody was kind of bailing out, and So I moved from Portland, Oregon, down to Lodi, California, where I'd grown up. And I thought, well, this would probably be a good time to start a company.
Okay, yeah. Interest rate in double digits. The fuel crisis of the Western world is rocking governments, you know, everyone all over the place. And you said now's the time.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, in most situations, great recessions and people being laid off and those sorts of things end up being also incredible periods of innovation.
This is true. And as many listeners will know, because they are in the trade, so to speak, or they're adjacent to it, alcohol as a category tends to be fairly resilient in the face of both economic downturn and in the face of boom times too, right? When things are good, people drink. When things aren't so good, people tend to drink. So, okay, so you knew you wanted to start a business. Before we get into the business that would come forth from this moment of sort of innovation and creativity, Stuart, tell us a little bit about what you personally, we refer to drinking careers maybe here on Tap Lines. What did your drinking career look like? What were you imbibing in at that moment in your life?
Actually, I was more into fine wine. My grandfather had fought in World War I in France and had developed a taste for fine wines and had introduced the rest of my family into fine wines. And so we were kind of a bunch of wine geeks. And I'm from Lodi, which was, you know, really where Robert Mondavi grew up.
Sure.
And a big part of the wine industry is still in Lodi. And it's probably one of the biggest wine growing regions in California.
Mm. So you were more into like traditional, you know, bottled wine, I guess is the way to put it. What was the broader drinking landscape like at that time? Who were kind of the major players in wine and beer, as you remember them? Like, what were your peers drinking if they weren't drinking wine?
Well, most of my friends, I think, were drinking beer. And I was drinking beer as well. But the beer industry at that time was so different than it is today.
Sure.
I mean, it was really gotten down to Coors, Anheuser-Busch, and Miller.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, Sierra Nevada was just getting going. You had a couple of microbreweries that were getting started.
Anchor was there. New Albion.
Yeah, Anchor Beer, of course, was there. And
Mendocino, maybe?
I'm not sure. You know, and I'm not an expert on beer, but very few microbrews. And it was just they had shrunk it down to the point where, you know, it was just the big boys slugging it out, and Anheuser-Busch was pretty much crushing everyone.
Mm.
And so that was the cold box, really, in most stores, just had a couple things in it. And, you know, Anheuser-Busch kind of dominated multiple shelves on the in a cold box, and there wasn't much else. There were some imported beers.
Yeah, Heineken, right, was starting to come on strong at that point. Listener, if you're interested in the Heineken story, we have a previous Tap Lines episode with Philip Van Munching, who was the son of Leo Van Munching, who was, of course, the importer of Heineken here in the United States. I encourage you to go back and check those out. So, Stuart, that's what was in the cold box. You know, fine wine is starting, California is starting to make a name for itself in the more old world wine scene, because there was a relatively groundbreaking moment right around that era when California wine started getting recognition in a French wine competition, if I'm not mistaken. Does that ring a bell to you?
Oh, absolutely. The tasting of I think it was 76.
76 is coming to mind. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah. And that was kind of a groundbreaking period. Of course, what was interesting is nobody really realizes that the French wines had a series of bad vintages, and California seems to have pretty good vintages because our weather's pretty good.
Yeah.
And so, of course, we're tasting our good vintages against their worst vintages.
Right.
And then we go, wow, we won. We're so amazing. But nobody ever brings that up.
Well, no one likes to spoil a good story. We can't let facts get in the way of a good story, Stuart. Come on.
You and I agree on that subject.
But, okay, so that's sort of what the drinking landscape looks like. People are starting here in the United States to become more hip to, you know, to wines. I know I read Secret Life of Groceries, which is a tremendous book by Benjamin Lohr that talks in part about Trader Joe's starts to focus on wine. Joe Colombe, you know, sort of implements a wine program at the grocery store that was, for its time, very pioneering. The American drinking public, right around that time, the American drinking public, the point I'm trying to make, is starting to be awake to the idea that, wow, we've got tremendous wine coming out of California. You obviously were already awake to it, Stuart. And yet the place you decided to, or the niche you decided to build your business in, the one we're talking about today, California, or what would come to be known as California Cooler, it's a wine-based product, but it is not something that it sounds like fit into your preference as a drinker personally. Tell us a little bit about why that is and how that came to be.
Well, I was interested in wine and drinking wine, but
sure.
I was really interested in starting a business, and I had an idea of, I had some criteria of the business I wanted to start. I wasn't anxious to start a wine business.
Yeah.
I was just interested in, you know, starting a company or making a living. And I was trying to figure out what I was going to do. And I was looking at all sorts of ideas. And I had four criteria I was looking for. And frankly, none of the ideas I was looking at met those four criteria.
What were some of the other ideas? Do you remember?
Oh, gosh, I was looking at the junk business. I was looking at some kind of a greenhouse operation. I can't even remember the number of ideas I was looking at. But, you know, I was scrutinizing all these different ideas and so forth. And then I met my old buddy, Mike Crete, and for a beer. And we were sitting around talking about what we were doing and so forth. And he said that he wanted to start this business with this wine cooler.
Mm.
And he was calling it Island Wine Cooler. And I thought, wow, that sounds like a cool idea. And he goes, you want to try one? And I said, sure. So sure enough, he had a couple old, he was a wine salesman for a local winery. And he called on all sorts of retail stores and bars and this, that, and the other. And so he had gotten a bunch of empty beer bottles, washed them out, and he would fill them with this wine cooler, just kind of fooling around with this idea. So we sat around and drank wine coolers that afternoon. And I went home that night and thought, well, why don't I run this idea by my criteria? And sure enough, it fit perfectly. Yeah. And so I called him the next day and I said, hey, Mike, would you like to do this business with a partner? And everything Mike and I had ever done was a success.
Mm.
Everything we'd done together had turned out really well. And he said, absolutely. And so we started off and we just started putting the business plan together and figuring out what we were going to do. And of course, we had to try and figure out if it was a good idea. So we did all sorts of things to try and do consumer research and figure out if anybody would be interested in this thing.
Yeah.
And one of the things we did was we threw a great big party.
That's what passed for consumer trial when you were just starting out, right?
Right. And we had every kind of alcoholic beverage and non-alcoholic beverage you could imagine. Hard liquor, all sorts of beers, imported beers, this, that, and the other, and wine coolers. And we invited 100+ people to this party, and it was in a summer afternoon with a swimming pool and this, that, and the other. And we figured everybody was going to drink one wine cooler just to be polite.
Right, right.
So we eliminated the number of people times one wine cooler, and we set that aside, thinking, okay, if they hate it, they won't get a second one.
Sure.
So we only counted the second wine cooler that the people drank.
So you were doing basically like a depletion poll, right? Like afterwards, you're counting up the empties. Yeah.
And so we counted all the empties and we measured out the liquor bottles and the beer bottles and the cans and everything else. And wow, people liked the wine cooler pretty good. You know, it wasn't going to, you know, it wasn't 100%. It wasn't 60%, but it was, if it came anywhere as close to what happened that day, we had a potential success on our hands.
Tell us a little bit about what that liquid was at that time. I mean, wine cooler is the term you're using, but from what I understand, like, that was a term that came from the product that you guys eventually put on the market, California Cooler. Wine cooler as like a segment or as a type of beverage was not really a formalized like product just yet. What did you guys, how were you making it at that point, and what were you calling it?
Well, we called it a wine cooler.
And right, of from course, the jump? Gotcha, gotcha.
You had a spritzer at those times, and you could order a wine cooler at a bar or whatever, and of course they would always be made up differently. And our particular wine cooler was kind of a, it was 50% white wine, and it was kind of a Mai Tai and a Tom Collins with wine mixed. Okay, so if you imagine a Tom Collins, a Mai Tai, and a pour in a glass of wine, that was about what it was.
More or less. And then you were bottling it up in what, long neck beer bottles at the time when you were just prototyping it?
Yeah, when we were prototyping it, they were going into long neck beer bottles. And then we ended up using a bottle. It was more like a Heineken style bottle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Where were you sourcing the, just like commodity wine from a vineyard, or how were you sourcing the wine?
Sourcing the wine was, Mike worked for a company. My partner worked for a company called Eastside Winery. And we would go over and take over a 55 gallon barrel and fill it up, or a couple of them, and drive it back over across the street where we ended up doing our plant. This was a year later. And we drive the forklift across the road and into our winery building or garage, so to speak.
Very OSHA certified there. Yeah.
Oh, totally. And then, of course, we were bottling it by hand with a hose and a hand capper, like a home beer maker would do.
Sure. Okay, so this is, we started in 1980, and you guys are prototyping this, you have this party, it goes really well, you're seeing some, what people would later call, you know, sort of, you know, marketing beverage alcohol professionals now would call, like, repeat trial or repeat, you know, customer, whatever. So that's a good sign, right? You guys already knew that you were good business partners. When does this become a business? When does this become a formal thing? When do you guys hit the consumer market with California Cooler?
It took us about a year. We had to do shelf life studies. We did some other studies. We also developed the 4-pack. There were no 4-packs at that time on the marketplace. Everything was a 6-pack, if it had a carrier at all. And we did that with my up at Chico. My younger brother did a survey for us, and we interviewed a bunch of college students at Chico on a warm afternoon. And then we started actual production in 1981, and we got our capital, our investors, on August 15th of 1981.
Mm-hmm. How much did you start it up with? I mean, what was it? What did it take to start up a business like this back then?
$140,000.
Okay. So that's not a little bit of money. I mean, that's a fair chunk of change, especially given what the economy was doing at that time.
It's true. You could buy 3.33% of the company for $9,333. And we would have, man, we would have taken anybody because we were desperately looking for people who had come up with $9,333. And we ended up with a guy who owned a bar, Bill Simone, and Don Carl, who was a lineman for the phone company, and an accountant, and my father, and my younger brother. And then we had a well-to-do, very successful businessman in the next town over in Stockton. And he was our kind of our big investor.
Your whale, the whale investor.
Our whale, yes.
Okay. So no like beverage alcohol, like companies or firms that were looking at that space, nothing like that?
No.
Yeah. So, okay, you guys get this, you scrape together this investment with a motley crew of whoever, you know, will take the meetings and who will fork over some money for some shares in the company. When you go to market with it, how do you start pitching this product that distributors probably aren't super familiar with, right? Like, as you said, you know, you can get a spritz or a wine cooler in a bar as something that the bartender mixes up, but people weren't packaging it and producing it as like a consumer packaged good product in the way that California Cooler would, you know, would become known for. What were the initial pitches like, Stuart?
Well, both Mike and I went out and pitched individual stores and, you know, 7-Elevens and grocery stores. And Mike was a salesman in the local area, so he was already calling on a lot of stores and bars and things like that. So he already had a pretty good network in the local area. So what we decided to do was go out and it was almost kind of like product research also by pitching accounts and going in and just saying we were salesmen with this new company called California Cooler. We never told anybody we were the chairman and the president. We just said we were salesmen, right? And
good.
Giving the impression there were actually other people in the company, right?
It's not a lie. It's just an omission of some other details, you know?
Yeah. And then we go out and pitch them, and, you know, a case of wine coolers was $10.75 for 24 bottles, so it wasn't a lot of money, and we also had this strategy of not allowing people to buy very much, and so, you know, you go into a store, and the guy says, yeah, I'll take five cases.
Yeah.
And, five cases, I can't sell you five cases. I can sell you two cases. And what the strategy was is if you went in the cold box and you were two facings wide, two cases fit in the cold box.
Mm.
That's it. Well, as soon as you sell 2 4 packs, you got to reorder.
Mm.
Okay. So the strategy was that if you you just brought it in and you got a reorder, well, it's selling.
Right.
Whereas they've only really sold 2 4 packs.
But the name comes up on the purchase order. The guy who's in the back running the numbers is like, oh, gosh, I got to order more of this. So, okay, so they're becoming more familiar with this product. I was like, oh, interesting, this brand. You know, it's moving. Yeah.
Yeah, and what was interesting, too, is it seemed to actually people were pretty receptive. Retailers were pretty receptive and this, that, and the other. So all of a sudden in Lodi and Stockton and this and the other, we're in, you know, like 60 or 70, 80 accounts.
Yeah.
And then we go to a distributor after we've placed all these accounts and we're selling all this stuff. And we say to the distributor, well, you know, we're with California Cooler. We're in the marketing department for California Cooler. It's a young company. And we were wondering if you'd like take on our product. Well, of course, distributors says, hell no. You know, I've never even heard of you guys.
Right.
And then you go, well, that's surprising, sir, because, you know, we're in 180 of your stores in your district. You are?
Yeah.
And we go, yeah, we're in so-and-so's and we're in Rick's and we're in this and you're in Rick's. And he goes, yeah, we're in Rick's. And he gets on the phone and he calls Rick. He goes, Rick, there's, you know, there's Bob down at so-and-so. And he says, do you have California Cooler in your store? And he goes, yeah, it's selling like hell, man.
Yeah,
people
yeah.
love that stuff. And the guy's just blown away because he never leaves his office, right?
Uh-huh.
So that was our strategy for selling everywhere. And then we'd go to another distributor, you know, a couple of months or so later when we could get our production up to the point where we could handle it. And then we'd go, you know, he's never heard of us. And we go, well, you know, we're selling Coors down in Lodi and Stockton and, you know, with so-and-so. And he goes, he gets on the phone, and he calls this guy, and the distributor says, yeah, we're selling, you know, 400 cases a month of this stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, it just snowballed like that.
Yeah. So what's the, like, how are distributors and retailers merchandising California Cooler? I mean, it's in the cold box, like you said. How did you guys want this beverage positioned? I mean, based on what you described, people are familiar with like the idea of a wine cooler. They know sangria, they know spritzes. It's a little different as a packaged good, but it sounds like there's uptake. What was the price point? Like how are you guys branding and positioning this? Like give us a sense for where you wanted it to fit in to what was already on the market, the beers that they were going to be looking, the light beer, of course, which was coming on very strong at that time. Mm-hmm. Budweiser Light gets introduced in 1982 and becomes Bud Light in 1984. Miller Light's already on the market. Where did California Cooler, ideally, in your mind at that time, fit in who was it competing with? What are, you know, they would refer now to the competitive sets, you know, like where did you see it fitting in into those competitive sets?
We were looking at it as a beer alternative, really. What we came to the conclusion of is all alcohol beverages are an acquired taste. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you don't just start drinking wine.
Right.
Wine doesn't taste very good when you start drinking it. Frankly, yeah. Beer doesn't either for most people. Although beer, because it's a lighter beverage, seems to be a better entry point for a person just starting to drink alcohol. Hard liquor, if you mix it with orange juice or, you know, slow gin with Coke or something, you know, kind of masks the flavor of alcohol. And California Cooler did not require such a acquired taste.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we found out much later, we didn't realize this when we started, is that 35% of beer drinkers don't like beer.
Okay.
But what they want is they want to be an adult.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to just be drinking a soft drink. If you're out on the boat water skiing, you don't want to be the guy who's or girl who's just drinking, you know, soft drinks and
sure,
stuff. You don't
sure.
want to be dragging mixers and ice and glasses and stuff like that with you. You want something that's convenient and adult.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you don't like beer.
Mm-hmm.
So California Cooler was a really fun, convenient. I mean, it had a twist-off cap. You didn't even need a church key.
Yeah, yeah. When these days, and I'm kind of cutting ahead here, but this is a good opportunity to do it, smash cut back to the present, and one of the things that analysts of the beverage alcohol industry these days talk about, especially given the boom of hard seltzer late last decade and into the early of this decade, is something called the pool party test. The idea of like, hey, can you, you know, have it and have a good experience at you know, a pool party type environment? So that requires some portability. It requires it to be light. It requires it to not have challenging flavors that require, you know, acquisition of a taste over the course of years, right? Like a wine or a whiskey or whatever. It strikes me as, and this is something I wanted, and this is part of the reason I wanted to do this episode, it strikes me that California Cooler, before people were even talking about the idea of a pool party test, California Cooler was acing the pool party test.
Totally.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So you guys sort of stumbled across, and maybe you knew, or maybe that was the target the whole time, but you found a drink that people were going to be, you know, sort of incorporating into this type of, you know, active lifestyle, light beer, you know, light beer alternative, more flavor than, you know, maybe the Bud Light, the Miller Light of the world. Okay, so that's where California Cooler fits in, or where you guys hope it fits in. Tell us, you're starting to get traction. When does California Cooler sort of blow up? Because it does blow up, right, Stuart?
Oh, it totally blew up. And of course, one of the issues was, we were bottling it by hand when we started in 1981.
Right, yeah.
I went down to Southern California and bought some really junky bottling equipment a number of months later that we bootlegged a few mechanics around the town to come and help us install.
Yeah.
And, you know, we got up to a whopping 35 bottles a minute in production. And
which probably felt like a lot for you guys. I mean, because you were previously doing it all by hand.
It felt like a huge amount. And so what was happening was we were expanding our sales and production really based on what we could produce. So it was selling as fast as we could produce it. And we would just open up new territories. So we'd open up the next distributor in Solano County or Napa County or this county or whatever it was. And we were going with Coors beer distributors.
Okay.
My partner, Mike, loved the Coors guys.
Yeah.
And they were all professional baseball players or football players and stuff like that. Or X.
You mean the distributors, like the guys who got the Coors distributorship. Sure. Yeah.
It was, you know, Clark Miller and Napa was a professional football player,
sure,
I guess.
Yeah.
And
these days it's car dealerships, but back then it was beer distributorships. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. And we weren't advertising really at all. We were just, you would put a floor stack on the floor and it would sell like hotcakes.
Wow.
And you'd put a couple of facings in the coal box. And during that period of time, the Coors brothers were quite a conservative family.
And Bill and Joe.
I don't remember if you recall during that time, but one of the Coors brothers was a bit homophobic, and he's made some comments that were not well received in a lot of areas.
To say the least.
Yeah. So all of a sudden, Coors sales are just plummeting.
Interesting.
But the Coors distributors who are going, you know, shut up, buddy. Stop saying those things.
Yep.
And they were losing shelf space and they were losing sales.
Sure.
And they had to make that up. And all of a sudden California Cooler was in their warehouse, and we started picking up their facings. We started picking up their sales efforts, and we were doing 50 and 100 and 150 case floor displays on end aisles and big grocery stores. And it just exploded. And then we started opening up new states.
That's fascinating. So this was, and listener, if you're interested in hearing more about the Coors dynamics and the Coors family's politics, you can go back and check out an episode that we did here on Tap Lines with Dr. Allison Brantley, who wrote the book Brewing a Boycott, about that entire long saga between the Coors family and progressive activists and LGBTQ advocacy groups and whatever. But that's so fascinating, Stuart. So their loss, in a sense, is California Cooler's gain, because the distributors need something to move. They got to put something on the trucks. Mm-hmm. People aren't buying Coors because they're getting, the company, the brand, is getting hammered by boycotters and by activists who are pointing to Bill and Joe Coors, you know, comments to the press, their political donations, et cetera, as reason not to drink the beer that bears their name. So the distributors are like, well, thank God we got this California Cooler that people do want to drink, because otherwise we wouldn't have anything to sell.
That's it.
Wow.
I'm sure people were still drinking.
Sure.
A lot of people were still drinking Coors, but you know, you have a 25 or 30% drop in your sales. That is painful for the distributor. And they fought for years to get the shelf space and the awareness in those stores that they have, and they didn't want to lose that because the Coors brothers had a bad attitude.
Yeah. Wow. So, man, talk about serendipity. I mean, obviously, California Cooler is performing well. It's getting repeat, you know, in the retail stores that you're in. But this sounds like it helped contribute to a massive uptick in sales.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. Wow.
And you know, we're still in the situation where we can only sell as much as we can produce.
Right.
And at this stage, you know, in 1983, by this time, in 82, we started looking for a new facility where we could put in a much, much faster bottling line. So we moved to, there wasn't a building big enough in Lodi to house us. And so we moved to Stockton to a industrial park.
Mm-hmm.
Within about 18 months, we'd taken over the entire industrial park.
Wow.
And we had traveled to Europe looking for really high-speed bottling lines, and we had two bottling lines that were the second fastest bottling lines in the world.
No kidding. Where did you get them? Is that a German product? Who's making the best bottling lines back then?
Well, the labeling machines and foiling, we have a foil that's very much like Beck's or some of
neck.
Those, where it's that foil sort of thing. And that was Krones out of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And we bought six Krones labelers, three for each bottling line. And we went like 1,700 bottles a minute. You couldn't even see the product. You could only see what color it was.
Yeah, the blur as it's going by. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question, Stuart. What did the Germans think you were up to? Did they understand what you were talking about when you told them, hey, we're doing wine coolers and we're doing this volume and we need this this machine?
They just wanted to sell us a machine.
they don't care what you're using it for.
They weren't worried about what we were using it for. They didn't care about that at all. I did meet Hermann Kronsäter, and he flew us over to Germany, myself, our operations manager, and my head mechanic, and we had a great trip. They were all super excited to be in Germany and going through all these. And we went through bottling lines all over Europe to get ideas and see what the highest technology was at the time.
Yeah.
And we built an unbelievable bottling facility in Stockton, and we were shipping a truckload of California Cooler every 15 minutes.
Wow.
7 days a week, 24 hours a day.
Wow. All in, what was the package? 4-pack of 12-ounce bottles?
It was a 4-pack of 12-ounce bottles, and there were 6 4-packs in a case.
In a case, gotcha. Eventually you guys introduced higher volume package, right? Or no, am I mistaken?
We did.
Yeah.
Okay. We introduced, you know, PET plastic, and we introduced, you know, a 2-liter. We also went to little bottles, 187s.
Little
which
ponies,
is just
Yeah,
little bitty guys, particularly for Japan.
Oh, interesting.
We introduced the product in Canada, in Japan, in Europe. And of course, by 1983 and 4, we were throughout the entire United States.
Yeah. Wow. That is a quick scale up to national distribution.
We had 75 sales reps, and we had a $40 million. By 1984, we had a $40 million ad campaign.
Whoa. Well, let me ask you a question, Stuart. Like, you guys, you know, your high school buddies, you obviously have an entrepreneurial mindset, describing the way you sort of were looking for business opportunities. That said, I mean, that's just a tremendous amount of money and a tremendous scope of an operation for you to be managing. How did you handle this? I mean, that's got to be pretty intense to scale up that fast and to be dealing with that kind of budget.
It was really something. I was 27 years old. Mike and I were 27 when we started this thing, and we'd never done anything like this.
Yeah.
And it was like, wow, man, we grabbed onto the bumper of something, and it took off, and it turned out it was a race car.
Yep.
And what was interesting was, you know, that $140,000 we started with?
Yes.
We never raised another nickel.
Wow. It was all just on cash coming in the door.
We did the whole thing on $140,000, and we never borrowed a dime of money.
Wow. No debt ever.
No debt.
And, Holy smokes.
We used obscure. I was a international business major, and before we started California Cooler, I had done some international trade, and there was this thing called a letter of credit that people used because, you know, you're afraid some guy in Nigeria is not going to pay you. So you get the bank to write a letter and says, well, if that guy didn't pay you, we'll pay you. So I thought, why don't we use that with our suppliers? So, you know, all these suppliers, you know, they're 20% interest. Companies are going bankrupt all over the place. You know, they desperately need sales, but they're so nervous. And here's these two 27-year-old guys who come into their office and they're going, yeah, right. You know, we're gonna make a bunch of glass and give it to you dudes, you know.
And, yeah. And they're saying cash on delivery, buddy.
Exactly. And so we said, well, look, why don't we do this? We'll give you this $50,000 letter from our bank. And if we don't pay the bill, give us 30 days to pay our bill. If we don't pay the bill, you just take it to the bank, and the bank guarantees they'll pay the invoice. Oh, that sounds pretty good. Okay.
And that's secured. That was secured against your cash in that bank.
Well,
how is it secured?
Not really. It was my whale investor, Bud Klein, he was on the board of the bank. And he said, give these guys a $150,000 line of credit.
Okay. So you guys had like a revolving line of credit from this bank.
Right.
Yeah,
which
gotcha.
We never used.
Yeah.
We said, instead of giving us money, give us three $50,000 guarantee letters. Okay. And then what we'd do is we'd go to each, some of our suppliers, and we'd say, we'll give you a $50,000 guarantee. And after 90 days, if we pay our bill every time, after 90 days, we want our credit to go to $100,000, of which we'll keep the $50,000 as a guarantee. Then after another 90 days, if we've never paid a bill late, we want you to drop the guarantee requirement.
Gotcha.
And we want to go up to $150,000.
Yeah.
Well, So we just, and then we just kept swapping these guarantees around from supplier to supplier to supplier.
Yeah, yeah.
That's but what was really great was the beer industry was on a 15-day payment program.
So they, wow.
So they were used to paying in 15 days. And anytime a distributor would say, well, you know, we want to pay you in 30 or 60 or something like that, we'd go, well, gosh, all our other distributors are paying us in 15.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something about your credit we should know?
Mm.
Oh, no, no. So we got paid in 15 days and we had to pay our bills in 30. And so the faster we grew, the more excess money we generated. And by the end of the, in a 3 or 4 years, we had $40 million in the bank.
Wow. So you guys had what accountants would call an accelerating cash flow. Although I suspect a lot of beverage alcohol accountants who might be listening to this are have their head in their hands being like, holy smokes, these guys were playing it fast and loose with getting those notes of credit. And that is not how you build a business these days necessarily, but well, it is to some extent, but man, that's intense is I guess what I'm trying to say, Stuart.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So
and it worked out really well.
It did.
We never paid a bill late, not one ever. And our cash flow worked perfectly. And I mean, we built our bottling lines. It was a $10 million expansion. And 3 years after we started the company, we financed the whole thing out of cash flow.
Wow. That's very unusual.
Yeah.
Okay. So you guys are running hot. This, you know, this product is taking off. You said you were shipping to Japan at one point. How many international markets were you in?
Canada, Japan, and parts of Europe, Denmark.
Gotcha.
You know, some other countries. Yeah.
Got it. Places that
I wouldn't say international was our big thing. Yeah. That was kind of late in the program for us.
Gotcha. So, Stuart, this thing, you know, this product is taking off, like you said. At what point does the rest of the beverage alcohol industry catch wise to what these guys over at California Coolers are up to? When do you start seeing competition or, you know, Me Too type copycats move into this segment that California Cooler is kind of pioneering?
It was really interesting because, of course, early on, for the first little while, we were only selling what we could produce. So we were limited by our production. So we didn't advertise and we didn't promote ourselves. We also made sure that we never talked to anybody like a podcast like this. Okay. We never talked to the newspapers. We never talked to the... We never really promoted this because what we realized was most executives never leave their office.
Mm-hmm.
They know nothing about the marketplace and that there's communication-wise, you know, a salesman might see a new product in the grocery store, the liquor store, or something like that, but he's not talking to the president either.
Right.
And there's not a strong communication between the people who are out in the marketplace and the people at the executive offices. So those guys were completely unaware.
They got caught off guard. Yeah.
Yeah. Until the Gomberg-Fredrickson report came out, where these two guys who do statistics on the industry were flipping through a bunch of papers of who was making sales and who was dominating the wine industry. And they come across this company they've never even heard of who's selling 2 million cases a month. And they go, holy Christ, you know, this is the second largest winery in the United States.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wow. Also, what's the name of the report? Gomberg what?
The Gomberg-Fredrickson report. It was the Gomberg report at that time.
Okay.
And they gave you all this statistics on what was selling out of grocery stores and liquor stores and what was selling on premise and this, that, and the other. And kind of an analytical industry report. And we had gone completely under the radar until that point. And that was about 1983.
Okay.
They came out.
And that's when the C-suite at some more established corporate beverage alcohol firms start taking a look at what you guys are doing.
Yeah. And then there was about 67 or 80 different competitors.
How quick? Like overnight?
Well, pretty much. Yeah. There were some other competitors in. There was a product called Stidell's that was in a can. There was Sun Country Wine Cooler, which was Canandaigua Wine Company. They had come out with a product, and they actually had a pretty good distribution and so forth. It was a little, their product was a little silly, I thought. But, and then, then Gallo got into it. And that was Bartles and James. And they would hover their company air helicopter over the top of our plant for, you know, an hour at a time. And they
doing like they recon?
And they put a guy out in our parking lot. He just sat there like 8 hours a day, you know, counting all the trucks that were going in and out.
Wow.
And photographing and stuff like that. It was kind of like, you know, the Russians or something. Right, their spies. We would take him coffee in the morning and, you know, bring him out donuts and stuff. We felt really sorry for the guy.
Yeah, yeah. That's a tough assignment for Ernest Gallo to send you to go bird dog a company called California Cooler. When you thought you were, man, I thought I was going to be working in the vineyards in Modesto. I was, you know, like, no, man, you're going to sit in an industrial lot in Stockton, California and take photos of 18-wheelers.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's too funny. Okay, so they introduced Bartles and James in what, like 86, I want to say?
84? No, I think they were 84, okay. I think early 84, something like that.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Thereabouts. Okay. What's what does that do to your business? Do you guys, is it a pinch you feel immediately? I mean, E&J Gallo at that time, biggest winery or wine company in the country, hard charging also, like they're sort of notorious listener. Our listeners, of course, Stuart, are maybe less familiar with the wine industry, but the beer industry. E&J Gallo sort of has a reputation at that time for being pretty sharp elbowed, right? I mean, this is about as stiff competition as you might be unlucky enough to draw.
Oh, absolutely. And I have to say, E&J Gallo, they may be sharp elbowed, but they're smart as can be. Mm. They executed brilliantly. Their salespeople are amazing. Their distributors are top tier.
Mm-hmm.
Their marketing department is exceptional. Let me tell you, it's the it's the major leagues when you're up against E&J Gallo. And we had 67% of the U.S. wine cooler market when E&J Gallo came out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we dropped a little bit. And then we made some adjustments and started climbing back up a little bit. But they actually used our story to tell their story. So it was Mike and Ed or whatever, they're two old guys. Well, it was Mike and Stu, you know, and they started, and their whole folksy little story of being a little hometown thing and thanks for your support. They had it down our story to the exact pickup truck that we were delivering our wine coolers in.
Wow.
They had the same year and model of pickup truck.
Wow.
In their advertisements as Mike and I, we just chose one story and they chose the our other story.
They chose your story though.
Yeah. Yeah.
you're talking about, in case anyone's not familiar, you're talking about the Bartles and James characters in their advertisements.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Gotcha.
It was very clever.
That had to feel a little personal. Yeah. I mean, very clever. Yeah. It had to feel a little personal too. No,
it did. Yeah. And their advertising executive, Hal Riney, was brilliant.
Yeah.
And he was a guy who did Henry Weinhardt's advertisement, and it was so clever. And he was really clever.
Hal Riney was kind of a legend in the advertising space for his era, San Francisco ad guy, right? Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Bartles and James did a great job.
Yeah.
And right around that time, some of my investors, my partner, were really getting a little nervous. And my partner in particular was anxious to maybe sell the company.
Mm-hmm.
This had been an unbelievable experience to go from, you know, filling bottles with a hose and hand cappers to the second largest winery in the United States and selling 20 million cases a year in 4 years. That was pretty intense, and it was unbelievable growth.
Yeah. That's like going through warp speed, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there was a little bit of nervousness. And so everybody thought that maybe we should put the company up for sale.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't very excited about that. But I thought, you know, Mike and I agreed that And he and I'd had a little bit of a falling out right about that time. And we decided, okay, you know, let's work together and we'll put the company up for sale. Mm-hmm. And we ended up marketing the company to a number of executives and things like that, other corporations. And Brown-Forman ended up buying the company. And actually, 4 years to the day, August 15th, 1985, we sold the company to Brown-Forman, and we had shipped our first case August 15th, 1981. We shipped our first case of California Cooler. So 4 years to the day, we sold the company.
Wow. Go figure, man. So, Stuart, let's zoom out a little bit. This is, you know, you just took us through this, I mean, rocket ship ride to the moon that you guys took with the brand. You're selling millions of cases a month. You're getting competition from some of the biggest winery, you know, the biggest winery in the country. Also, by the way, listener, there was an aborted attempt by Miller Brewing Company a few years later to roll out a wine cooler of their own, Matilda Bay. I don't know if you remember that one, Stuart, but it failed almost immediately. It was only on the market for like a year or so. It was late to the party also. Seagram's is involved. You created this, sort of built this segment out of nowhere. I guess like what I was hoping to talk about, I sort of teased earlier, we briefly mentioned it earlier, when you look back at sort of the wine cooler boom, and it dropped off, of course, by the 90s, sales were dramatically down. And I think eventually, I'm sure you know, so at some point, someone, Brown-Forman sold it off to someone else, right?
Brown-Forman seemed to be able to destroy anything they bought. They bought the company. I continued to run it for them. I was the president of the company for about a year.
Yeah.
And it continued to do well during that period of time. But then they started making changes that I completely disagreed with. Mm. They decided to give the product to their hard liquor salespeople, their distributors, even though those guys worked on a completely different pricing structure. They weren't familiar with a cold box. They didn't even go into the stores that oftentimes California Cooler was sold in. It was a disaster.
Oh, man. Yeah, yeah.
For them. And of course, the Coors distributors and the distributors we had been working with felt
spurned.
Oh, totally,
yeah,
burned.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had a technique of burying the product inside the store in the company boxes, but not the California Cooler boxes. So they would fill the product in their beer boxes because they fit perfectly and put them on the bottom of a pallet. So the computer showed they had plenty of stock. So they would never reorder.
Yeah, yeah.
The brand went from, you know, 50% of the U.S. market to zero overnight.
Whoa.
And Brown-Forman just tanked it. And then they sold it to Stroh's, who was nearly in bankruptcy.
Oh, man. Yeah, you don't want to be getting sold to Stroh's in the late 80s, man.
Exactly. And Stroh's was in so much debt, they came in and put a lien on all of our bottling equipment.
Oh, no.
Well, our labelers were worth $750,000 apiece.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and our bottling machines, our Crown Cork and Seal fillers were worth $1.5 million. Well, Stroh's just went, wow, man, this is, you know, and they could borrow more money so within months, Stroh's was bankrupt and they were coming in and unbolting the equipment and hauling it off.
Oh, man. Yeah, yeah. Oh, what a disaster. So an unceremonious demise for California Cooler.
Unceremonious. It was heartbreaking.
I bet. So, okay, let's look back on, you know, come back with me to the present day now and look back on the boom that California Cooler sort of, you know, triggered around wine coolers. And then, Stuart, indulge me, if you will, and compare it to what you see in the beverage alcohol landscape today. I mentioned the hard seltzer, you know, sort of boom and plateauing of that market, but we're also living through an era that, in many ways, and I'm not the first person to make this point, wine coolers like California Cooler kind of presaged. I mean, we're seeing real popularity and traction in flavored malt beverages, flavored wine, you know, beverages with a wine base that are you know, flavored in a way that's sort of reminiscent of wine coolers. Do you see a direct line or sort of some connectivity between, you know, the popularity of the quote-unquote alternative space now and what you guys were doing back then?
Totally.
Yeah.
And actually, there was a continuity that went even further. If you go back into the 70s and you look at the pop ones, you had Ripple, you had Annie Greensprings, and things like that. They were kind of a light spritzy or apple wines and this, that, and the other. They were maybe not as conveniently packaged. They weren't quite the same, but they were of the same genre. And some of these products would come and then they would go and then someone would bring out something new. What's a fascinating story is when we were doing California Cooler, we went up and worked with a guy named Anthony Von Mindel in British Columbia. He also was in his 20s and started handling California Cooler and distributing it in Canada. And then he later introduced Mike's Hard Lemonade.
And of course, listener,
and
White Claw.
White Claw.
Yep, there you
so
go.
Anthony Von Mindel was the real guy because he did California Cooler in Canada, then Mike's Lemonade, then White Claw.
Wow.
I mean, he has crushed the alternative category.
Boy, that is wild. I did not realize that connection.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not a stretch to say that White Claw is a cousin of California Cooler. I mean, this is in the family tree, so to speak.
Totally.
Yeah.
And I think that the real issue here is, why did it evolve from wine? And most people don't really realize that what ended up happening with California Cooler was an anomaly also. And that was in 1981, California had the most unbelievable wine crop, grape crop, in its history. And every single tank in the entire state was full. And they couldn't fit another gallon into tanks or barrels in the state. And yet, in another 12 months, you're going to have another crop.
Yeah.
So prices of wine plummeted.
Wow.
We were buying wine for 40 cents a gallon.
What should it be?
In those days, 10 bucks.
Whoa.
Okay.
Okay. So we're talking about glut prices. Yeah. Yeah.
Totally glut prices. And we were buying a million gallons a month. And 2 million gallons later, when we started in 83 and 84, we were absolutely draining this lake. I was the keynote speaker along with the governor of California for the California Wine Grape Growers. He spoke first. And when I stood up to go speak, I got a standing ovation from these wine grape growers. And the governor was miffed. Why would this guy, this kid, get a standing ovation from a bunch of wine growers? And he's the governor, you know, for God's sakes. Anyway, we emptied those tanks
so they
had someplace to go with their crop.
Oh, I love that, man. There's like a serendipity there that I feel like is so often hidden from the end consumer and certainly hidden from history unless we get the opportunity to speak to someone who is there like you were. But it reminds me of like the McDonald's McRib product is rumored to only be, it's a limited product, and it's rumored that the only reason they introduce it is when pork belly prices plummet low enough that it makes sense for McDonald's to buy it in mass and produce the product. Obviously, California Cooler and McRib have nothing to do with one another, but like, I love those little details where it's like the only reason that this product can succeed is because of the conditions that, you know, it sort of emerged from. There was a need that it was filling, and just like it was filling the need for the Coors distributors, like because of that, you know, it helped it really take off. Man, that's crazy. I love that.
Well, and today wine's so much more expensive. That's why they're using malt liquor primarily. And that's the base because you can control it with grain instead of wine.
Or cane sugar, and you don't even have to have any grain in it. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Go figure. Stuart, that was a fantastic story. Thank you so much for joining us here on Taplines. Well, last question for you that, you know, is sort of a way to wrap it up. For those listeners, because this is a beer podcast, and like we learn from history, or we're doomed to repeat it, or whatever the phrase is, what is the lesson that you'd like our listeners to take from the rise and the fall and the legacy of California Cooler? What do you think it says about sort of beverage innovation? I mean, you've been in the business for many, many years. What's your main takeaway there?
You know, I think that there's going to be all sorts of opportunities throughout time to innovate in beverages, just like there's going to be opportunities to innovate in all sorts of things. For example, California Cooler was not a low-calorie product. Mm. If I was to introduce a product today, I would probably make it with zero sugar or make it way more low-calorie. The product would introduce today would not be the product we introduced then.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's always, people have a tendency to, successful businesses have a tendency to satisfy or fill a niche or solve a problem that is out there. And when that problem's solved, people kind of go to it. So I think there's always going to be alternatives to beer and wine and hard liquor. There's always going to be a market for that. Right now, it's being filled by White Claw and other beverages.
Sure.
And I think there will be other ones to come in the future.
Yeah, yeah. There's always going to be a new opening for people who are savvy enough to spot it. Wise words. Stuart, thank you so much for taking the time, taking us down memory lane. Of the wild ride that California Cooler was. We loved it here on Tap Ons. I loved it. I know our audience will too. You're welcome back anytime, my friend.
Thanks, Dave. Great talking to you.
Take care. Tap Ons is recorded in Richmond, Virginia, and produced by yours truly and Darby Seaside, who, along with the talented Shane Farrick, composed our delightful soundtrack. Just listen to it. I also want to give a quick shout out to the entire VinePair team, and especially co-founders Adam Teeter and Josh Mallon, editor-in-chief Joanna Sherino, managing editor Tim McCurdy, and art director Danielle Grinberg, who designed our lovely Taplines logo. And of course, a big thank you to you, yes you, listener, for spending time with us week in and week out. We literally couldn't do this without you. I'm Dave Infante, and I'll catch you next time.